Mm. Okay, so you're
So I've got good reason to you know, I mean, I've got my dad's done his stint, and my two brothers are doing it. And will Charles ever come home? And probably not. I mean, even my mum, I think, although she always said, I know he's still alive and I know he's going to come home, but, you know, we used to say that's probably wishful thinking. Don't see, when you hear the stories filtering out of how the Japanese were treating their prisoners of war, it's very doubtful that he'll ever come home alive, but bloody hell he did. You know, it's just the luck of the draw. Somehow or other, he survived.
Did this create any friction between you and the...
Oh, yes, yes, it did create friction, but more with my dad than my mum. On the quiet, on the side, when Dad wasn't in earshot, she would say, well, I think our family's done its bit, and I don't believe half of what the politicians say, and I don't believe that this war is about what they say it is. And they hoodwink people all the time. I don't believe all the lies that they tell. She was much less enamoured of... She wasn't such a sycophant or a snob as my old man. She wasn't deferential as my old man was.
She was more independent.
More independent. Yeah. Perhaps because of her upbringing.
Which was?
Well, which was as a very, very poor slum dweller in Blackfriars, South London, just the other side of Waterloo, where until she married Charlie Wright, her first husband, who was slaughtered at Mons or Ypres or somewhere, and moved into a tiny little house. Until she married, they never had running water. There was a water standpipe in the courtyard outside of these terrible, terrible slums. That's where my mother was brought up, and perhaps that's where she got her independence. She had no cause to thank the system, and all friends around her died of things like diphtheria. Women, neighbours died in childbirth from puerperal fever. Is it called? And things like that. Poverty, starvation. People trying to help each other, but like, you know, only being able to offer an egg or a carrot or something like that. And her experience of the First World War was the rich never suffered at all. I mean, she used to tell us this. Perhaps I got a little bit of the rebel spirit from her as well, because she used to say all this stuff about when in the Second World War the newspapers would be full of everybody is tightening their belts, everybody is pulling together, we're one nation, one family, all working as to the best of our ability for victory. She used to say rubbish, because she remembers the First World War, when the rich used to feed themselves up the West End on all the luxury foods there were available, while everybody else was rationed to, as she used to say, one potato and a stale crust of bread a week, which was a slight exaggeration, but you know what she meant. And so I must have got a bit from her. So she never used, but my old man could never understand it until, here's a strange thing, when Charlie came home from being a prisoner of war in Siam, Thailand as it's called now, and Jack was released from hospital, still a nervous wreck, still mentally seriously disturbed, but able to cope generally with life, hold down a job for a while and things like that. But and then his two sons, the younger sons, both become socialists, both were conscientious objectors. He either had to reject us and not want to ever see us again, turn us out of the home, the family home, or disown us, or he had to come to terms with it and try and find out what the hell's going on. He was very confused and disturbed, there's no doubt about that. He used to shake his head and say, I don't understand your reasoning. I can't, it's obvious, you know, the Nazis and all that. So, but later on in life, In the 50s, early... Now, he died... He died in 1954, I think. Late 40s, early 50s. He began to... Not soften exactly, but to sit... We used to sit down... Well, we used to take him over the... I used to take him over the road to the pub for a pint of beer. And we'd be sitting there. Or at home, we'd, you know... We didn't have television then, only the radio. We'd be sitting there, or... I'd say... He used to read the Daily Telegraph. Of course he would. I mean, naturally, that would be his natural paper, the Telegraph. You see, it's snobbery again. And anyway, and I'd say, what's the paper say today, Dad? What's the big news story? And we'd start chatting and talking about things. And then I remember one occasion when... It certainly wasn't in the Daily Telegraph. It may have been in the Daily Worker, but more likely the Herald, a Labour paper. I remember some years after the war, before Dad died, 51 or 52, there was a big article in the Herald, and I didn't buy the Herald, but somebody showed it to me, and I went out and got a copy of the Herald, and it was an article about the British industrialists... manufacturers and that, supplying Nazi Germany with rare metals, titanium and molybdenum, which they needed for their aeroplane engines or whatever, oil from the British-owned oil fields in the Gulf. There was an article, it was full of how the British aided the Nazis right up until... the day after war was declared, because there was a ship on its way with chrome ore. It was halfway across the North Sea when war was declared. Did they call it back? No, because it had already been paid for. And the apologists who had been interviewed in this article says you have to keep to a contract. You can't break a contract. We feel, you know, it's a civilized thing to do. So there was this ship full of rare... you know, chrome ore, because you mix chrome with steel to make hard steel, don't you? Chrome, titanium, whatever. On its way to bloody Germany and unloaded and everything, and thank you very much, they said, it's been paid for, you know, and have a good trip back. And the war has already been declared. And prior to that, there was no hesitation in supplying the Germans with everything they needed, because they could charge a high... Because Germany was building up an armaments and war industry and had already invaded Belgium and the rest of it. Austria, I mean. But they'd already... It was obvious what the Nazis were up to. They'd taken over Austria. And this is just before the war broke out. But it was obvious what they were up to. And yet the British had no qualms about... making huge profits out of charging the top price for these metals and oil and other things as well. It mentioned lots and lots of things that had been sent over. High tensile steel pipes for high pressure something or other, I seem to remember, which were offered by the Americans, but the British undercut the Americans and got the contract. And thousands and thousands of tons of these pressure pipes were shipped over to Germany for the war, for the German war effort, all for a tidy profit, of course. So I showed this to Dad. I said, what's your paper say today, Dad? He said, the Prime Minister's going to make a speech of something about that, and Sussex are doing well against Gloucester at the cricket. How about this? Read that. And I opened up this article in the Daily Herald, and I said, read that in peace and quiet, and I'll go and make a cup of tea. He was really shaken. He said, something like, yes. Is that what you were on about all this time? And I said, yes. So when my brother Sid came home, I said, I think we ought to have a talk with Dad, because I've given him a terrible shock. And I think we ought to sort things out, because we've never spoken about all this. And he began to soften and understand. He didn't say I want to join the Socialist Party. I mean, far from it. But he was. He said, "Yeah, I've got a lot of things wrong.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't. I had a very narrow view of the world and what's going on. You've got a much better understanding than ever I had. I begin to understand," which was a great comfort to us because, you know, you don't like to feel that you've reneged on your dad's principles and beliefs. So from then on, you know, we were pals again,
yeah,
which was nice.
Now, what kind of reaction did you have from your workmates, people you worked with on the
Tolerant, actually. Yeah. Quite tolerant, yeah. I mean, one didn't. It's like being gay. You don't necessarily have to go around shouting to everybody, "I'm gay." You don't necessarily have to go around shouting to everybody, "I'm a CO." But if they asked, "Aren't you of call-up age?" is usually how it would go. Weren't you called up then? Yes, I was called up, but they desperately needed bomb damage repair, glaziers and carpenters and that, because you can't leave buildings with the roofs off and all the windows out. How can the government function? And, oh, I forgot to mention, out of the blue, about 3-4 months after I'd registered as a conscientious objector and had been allowed to carry on doing the work I was doing, bomb damage repair, which I kind of exaggeratedly said was for government buildings, they wrote and said, "Change in your direction of labour. You are to leave the job you're in with, we understand, the firm of Osborne and Smith or something, and you are to report to Mr. So-and-so at the Ministry of Works, where your bomb damage repair work will now be employed." So they did look into this, and they must have smelt a little bit of a fishy smell, because I mean, we were actually doing was repairing and redecorating and renovating people's homes. A lot of it nothing to do with where a bomb had never dropped within 20 miles, and the firm were getting a lot of money because you couldn't get building workers then. But because the firm was registered as doing bomb damage repair, it could get materials and ladders and plaster and lead pipes and all that. So they were doing lots of jobs on the site and charging 10 times what it would normally have cost, because the house owners couldn't get that work done in those circumstances. Well, although we did do some bomb damage repair, but very, very few government buildings. So they must have gotten somebody. They must have had inquiry agents going around. So I got this order to report to the Ministry of Works. As it's now, what would it be? The Ministry of the Environment now, but it was called the Ministry of Works. And then from then on, I was employed by them, and did actually have to work on government buildings to such an extent that they sent me. A squad of us were ordered down to up to Welling Garden City. We were ordered up to Welling Garden City, and we're all saying we had to assemble at 6 o'clock at Euston State or Euston or whatever, King's Cross. I don't remember any bombs being dropped at Welling Garden City. Bomb damage repair up there. Anyway, we all had our tools with us, fucking heavy, you know, kit of tools. And when we got there, it was nothing to do with bloody bomb damage repair. It was a military encampment, and everybody was living in Nissen huts, and the officers had complained that they were living in cold, drafty Nissen huts. And nearby, there were some barns, big wooden barns, which had the space and were well constructed. And what we had to do was to put plasterboard up all around to make it into a nice, and divide the rooms off so that they could have comfortable offices and a mess. And plumbers were putting in pipes and sinks and ovens and stoves. Fucking offices, because they objected to living in like in the these corrugated this and that's just like the men. Just like, what do they call them? Officers and other ranks. That's right. They didn't want to live. So that's what we were doing there. But I didn't cause a fuss about it because I thought, well, if I complain or write to some newspaper that we were taken away from genuine bomb damage repair to do this, they might renege on, and they might call me up for the armed forces and show me what it's really like to be another rank. So I kept quiet about that. But anyway, that went on until I was released from, where's that? I was released, wasn't I? So, quite, I mean, on the 24th day of March 1948, I was, that's 3 years after the war. You see, they hung on to you for as long as they could, but in the March 1948, I was released from National Service or Direction of Labour, and could do what I liked after that. That's when I joined the party. October 1948. That's when I joined the party.
Yeah. During the war, you mentioned that people were thought to be joining the party as a get out.
Yes.
What did the party do to prevent that?
Ah, that's a good question. Yes. Well, there wasn't much you could do, because if they knew the case and answered the questions at the branch examination, as it was called then, you couldn't accuse them of, unless you had really, really strong grounds, you couldn't accuse them of using the party as a device. And I suppose that what you did, you just watched to see, you know, what they did and where they went after they were registered as a conscientious objector. If they disappeared, then you knew that you'd been used. But I have I remember other members telling me that although they suspected a number of people did join the party in order to get onto the bandwagon of this socialist opposition, which was understood by tribunals, generally speaking. Although, I mean, we haven't mentioned or stressed the fact that quite a number of party members actually were not registered, failed to be registered as a conscientious objector.
Why was that? Was it at a different tribunal?
Different tribunal, different parts of the country, different attitudes.
Yeah.
And many of them went to an appellate tribunal, and then a superior appellate tribunal. I mean, three or four attempts to be registered and still failed, and either went on the run, as some of them did, or else actually, you know, couldn't avoid, for family reasons, if they failed to be registered, they couldn't go on the run because of protecting and supporting their family. They had to accept the ruling and join the armed forces. That is really, really horrible. I can't remember, you probably perhaps have information about who some of these members were.
Would a party member in that position, having gone to the tribunal and failed, would he then be expected to resign from the party, or what was the party's attitude?
No, if I remember correctly, at that time the general feeling was that if you were called up in spite of all your efforts to be registered as a CO, then it wasn't your fault, and the fact that you were in the armed forces in spite of all that didn't mean that you should be asked to resign from the party or expelled. The other side of that coin was that if you voluntarily joined up or accepted your call up without appealing, without going through the appeal to be registered as a CO, then you should leave the party because, you know, or if you, I mean, especially if you volunteered. I mean, I understand, although I haven't got any details, I understand that because of, as the knowledge of what the Nazis were doing began to filter through, a couple of members actually did volunteer to join the armed forces to fight Nazis, especially, I think, one or two may have been Jewish members who began to hear about what the Germans were doing to the... Well, I mean, we knew before, even before the war, what their attitude was,
yeah.
but the details of the horror, the actual reality of the horror of what was happening, began to filter through. I think a couple of members did join up, but as far as I know, they were honourable enough to resign from the party before doing so.
Yeah.
So the only people who would be asked to resign, and if they didn't, would be expelled, would be those who still remained in the party, having volunteered to join, didn't make any attempt to become a CO. That's how I understand it. I mean, there are other members who may be able to correct me on this, but that's what I understand.
What can you tell me about, without naming names, what can you tell me about the party members who went on the run? What did they have to
do? Not a lot, because I see you want to get somebody older than me. I mean, I'm...
Yeah.
I know this sounds ridiculous, and I'm 70 in 2 weeks' time, I've mentioned that, but I did hear tales of members who went on the run, but I can't remember their names. Now, Gilmack, I think, was one. Gilbert McClatchy, he went on the run, didn't he? I can't remember their names. I should, as a fellow CO, or they were would-be COs but failed to be registered, I should know their names, I should know all about them, I should be proud of their ability to survive, and I feel awfully guilty in a way that I can't remember who they were.
I've spoken to Peter Lawrence.
Does he remember?
And he does remember, but he's reluctant to tell me anything.
Even though I've
guaranteed anonymity, he is unwilling to tell me anything other than some of his brothers, some party members were engaged in a certain amount of law breaking.
To survive. Yes, that I understand that. That's what I heard. But I don't know the details.
Yeah.
But surely Peter Lawrence can write down a member did this and a member went on the run.
I'll try, but
member saw the military police at the front door and did a bunk out of the back door, something like, I mean, without identifying her. Yeah. And subsequently he earned a living flogging something at some street market. I mean, you can describe what it was like and how you survived and avoided the military police and all that without mentioning names. I mean, I would if I could. I'm not putting this on. The reason why I'm not putting the details on the tape is because I don't know. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I mean, I know some of them. The only other one I know of is what my brother used to tell me about, which was a couple of chaps from the East End of London who were called up, and they weren't going to have anything to do with it, and they hadn't heard of the process, they hadn't understood the process of becoming a conscientious objector, although they were left wing. I mean, they weren't members of the Socialist Party, but they were probably CPs or ex-CPs or something, but they didn't want to know anything about it. And what they did was they went to a tool shop and bought a set of carpenter's tools, and the other bought a set of electrician's tools, and they turned up at site after site until at building sites and that, until somebody took them on, because there was a shortage of labour, And they put it about that they had a severe something, some internal disorder, kidney failure or something. And every now and then they'd have to drop down. This is my brother telling me. Every now and then they'd go, oh, 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 drop down on the floor, crouch and say, oh, oh, my kidneys. And somebody would bring them a glass of water and then they'd recover. And they would put on this act. And Sid and one of my brother Sid and one or two others, is this, I mean, you never hear them talking about going to the hospital or seeing a doctor. I mean, is it? And they had their suspicions. And one day, after Friday pay time, they went over to the pub, and these two chaps that had a also, the other tradesmen knew they were what we used to call chancers. I mean, they did pick up the skills as they went along. But when they first arrived, you could tell that the electrician had never wired a switch in his bloody life, but. People were very, strangely enough, although trade union demarcation and control was quite prevalent and strong then, because it was wartime, people were very more tolerant. And there could be some good reason why this poor chap's trying to earn a living and pretending to be a carpenter or pretending to be an electrician. And the tradesmen would help them, you know, instead of saying, piss off you bloody chancers, pretending to be a tradesman, how dare, all standing on their high horse, which is what a lot of people have the impression of trade unionists would have done. They were very helpful and tolerant. Anyway, cut a long story short, one day after they'd had three or four pints of strong beer, they let it out that they were on the run, and so that nobody would know they were on the run, they put it about that they were medically unfit for military service. One had rotted kidneys, and the other had something wrong with his, I don't know, something wrong with his legs or back or something. Anyway, that's how they survived. So I don't know whether party members tried that. See, I have heard of a party member who worked on the land as being on the run. Now, if you're working on the land, you've got land girls who have been called up and directed to do agricultural work. You've got disabled people who were not called up because of their disability working on the land. And you've got the governor who might have three sons fighting in the bloody African front or where have you. And two fit young men turn up from nowhere. And it's amazing how they got away with it, or, you know, why, I suppose some suspicious bastards would phone up the military and say, got two fit youngish men who don't look to me as there's anything wrong with them. I don't know whether that ever happened, whether the military police caught up with them. But they must have taken these members who went and disappeared into the heart of Lincolnshire or down in the middle of Hertfordshire or somewhere like that, and got a job on the land, they must have been taking a very serious chance, because in those small communities, somebody was bound to wonder. Perhaps they put it about that they had rotted kidneys. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
What problems did the party have post-war with members who were called up for national service? Or did the party not have members young enough to be?
Well, there were quite a few who joined who had been in the armed forces, but were no longer in the armed. I mean, you wouldn't have enrolled a member into the party who was still in the armed forces, even if they had been conscripted and it wasn't their fault, as you might say. But there were lots, I remember there were quite a few who had been in the armed forces. And I don't know whether you've heard of this, but towards the end of the war, the government, in their wisdom, thought it was a good idea, because there was a lot of unrest and feeling of awareness that pre-war, it was a very unfair, unjust, oppressive, exploitative society, mass unemployment, all the rest of it, and also partly as a result of the revolt of the armed forces in Asia. You know about the mutiny involving thousands and thousands of airmen and sailors and troops and that, who had been conscripted. The war was over, but they were the government attempted to keep them out there to maintain the empire, to fight Indian independent people, independence protesters, and all sorts of, I mean, they wanted them to bomb bloody Sarawak or something. And the Dutch asked the British government if they would bomb the rebels in Dutch East Indies. And they were all saying, sod this, we didn't join up to, you know, to keep the British government in power out here. Our job's done, the war's over. Well, at that time, and for other reasons, the government thought it was a good thing to have discussion meetings amongst the squaddies, to interest them in post-war, you know, the needs and all that, and also because they thought, I think some of the more knowledgeable or more prescient members of the government realised it was going to be a Labour government sooner or later, and they wanted to get in first, you know, with a bit of propaganda. They sent round these educational officers to instigate barrack room or squad room or aerodrome on board ship discussions, and they actually produced leaflets and pamphlets as guidance for these discussions. Of course, nobody took any notes of them, but still, it made it official. And I remember hearing of quite a few ex-servicemen who joined the party as a result of hearing left-wingers, maybe some ex-party members or people who knew about the party, or even CPers, because, I mean, although the CP was dominated by Moscow, but still, in many respects, I mean, obviously, as we accept that in many respects their analysis is appropriate, valid, and, you know, their expose of the nature of what they would call capitalism, excluding Russia, but still, anyway, there was a lot of people with those ideas, much to their amazement, being encouraged to spread them. And of course, once the cat had been let out, people were dashing off and buying books and that, and sending up off to, I suppose, SPGBers were sending off to head office for pamphlets, and the CPers would be sending off to King Street, Covent Garden, for their pamphlets. And many of these discussion things went on all day. And when the sergeant major, this is what party members were telling me, when the sergeant major came in and said, right, time for drill or something, or time to slop out the latrines, they would say, no, we haven't finished discussing, you know, what a Labour government's going to do, what it should do and all that. And the military were rather amazed at how it took off. But also, to give them credit, the government, well, not credit, but wisely, along with these discussion sessions and that, were offers of educational courses. So people, these education officers also had enrolment material and forms for servicemen who wanted to go on a crash. I don't know when they were crash courses. Well, they were courses set up for ex-servicemen free, like technical colleges or university or trade or building colleges. What do they call them? Colleges that teach
polytechnics.
Polytechnics, yes. Sorry, I couldn't think of the word. polytechnics, and many, many thousands did. They just snapped at the chance and got, you know, got a good training, or even you could enroll at to learn to be an artist. Or I mean, it wasn't restricted to technical matters or trade, or you know, or skilled trades. You could enroll to be, and if you thought you had it in you, even I understand some people who'd perhaps dabbled in first aid and things like that, went on courses to become doctors, things like that, and many of them did. So out of the government's fear of alienation of the population, because it was a coalition government then, out of their fear of alienating the people, and wanting to pretend that we're very grateful for all the efforts you've put in the war effort and all that, we're going to offer you all these opportunities, probably thinking that very few people would take them up. Actually, thousands did. Yeah. Must have cost a bomb, because it was offered as free courses, that, you know, the no tuition fees and every and all that. And so some party members, to my knowledge, either went through these long drawn out discussions, which were supposed to be organised by and controlled, guided by these education people who went, they had to go on a special course, make sure they don't talk about bloody revolution or socialism or anything like that. Keep them on general, broad general things like reforms and education and milk for babies, things like that. Of course, they were told to try and guide them, the squaddies, along these lines, but of course what happened was, I mean, there was an explosion of Ida, and they just couldn't stop people arguing. Members were saying about there were ding-dong arguments and all that, which was very healthy. And some of them joined the party as a direct result of the discussions, and perhaps being encouraged to read a bit of economics, political history or something like that, and which they perhaps wouldn't have done otherwise. So it did have some good effect, those members who'd been through all that were good, you know, they weren't passers by in the night, you know, I mean, they, once they'd sort of committed themselves, they were good, sound, long-term members. And the ones you were referring to earlier, who might have joined the party during the war just so as to be able to perhaps get the credence or the vicarious credibility by joining the party in order to register as a CO, and then once registered, but I don't think there were many of them. There might have been a few, but I don't think there were many.
Yeah. Yeah.
We would have heard.
What was the government's attitude to COs in the Second War, Liz?
Well, there was no conscientious objector propaganda. There was no nasty underhand or overt criticism. I think because, since they were claiming to be fighting for freedom and democracy, they had to pretend that even to the extent you had freedom, and even to the extent of registering as a CO, which lots of other countries wouldn't have allowed, you'd have been either shot or incarcerated. And the only propaganda I can ever remember is this very fact, this very situation, where whenever a minister or government spokesman wanted to uphold, praise the British freedom and democracy business, they would always mention why, in this country, we even allow people to, if they have a conscientious objection to serving, we even allow them to exercise that conscientious objection. Whereas in other countries, they shoot them or put them in prison for 20 years. Hard labour. So you've got a lot to fight for, and you should be very proud of being British. That's the only kind of proper, in general terms, but I can't remember anything worse than that. And certainly, apart from these references to because it's only, I mean, relative to the millions who were called out and fought in the Alpha, the number of COs was very small, so the British government could afford to be magnanimous about it and extol the virtues of freedom and democracy, blah, blah, blah. And that's the only reference, but generally speaking, they just kept quiet about it. It just, if it was an appropriate occasion, they would come out with that, what I've just said. Or, apart from that, there seemed to be a policy not to mention it at all.
I mean, how were they depicted in, say, films of the day? Was there any reference made?
No, I can't remember any reference to COs in films.
They weren't there, you know, you didn't get the CO portrayed as some kind of namby-pamby.
No. Wasn't there. And as you say, unlike the First World War, where local papers would publish the names of these traitors and cowards, and people would, as you mentioned earlier, would send them white feathers and all that, and or their houses, their front doors would be daubed with words like, because the hype, the First World War, patriotic, nationalist, let's all go at it hype, was absolute, I mean, unbelievably strong and overpowering and all pervasive. But in the Second World War, the government obviously, well, they were acting more intelligently from their point of view. I mean, better to
stay... From any point of view.
From any point. That's right. Stay stumm. Just don't mention it. And except, as a general principle, if there were one or two people who wanted to be a conscientious, we would allow it because we're for freedom and democracy. Like, it's just a... Theoretically, not that there are... It's just one or two, perhaps. That was... not encouraging people to be nasty or daub your front door or send you white feathers at all. Quite the opposite. You know, you have every right, providing you go through the procedure. And that was in contrast, complete contrast to the First World War.
And you didn't feel the tribunal you went to was weighed in any way. They gave you a fair hearing, do you think, Les?
Yes, I would say yes, actually. It was apart from these trick questions from this trade unionist.
Yeah.
And more, I think it was A.B. Swales, Esquire. I'm looking at the paper for those. Apart from him, the standard trick questions, it was pretty fair. I mean, another thing was, I think it was explained to me that because the war was nearly over anyway, I mean, it's 1945. June was the D-Day invasion, wasn't it? 44, right, sorry. Yeah, June 40, that's what I meant. June 44. So by March, May 45, you know, I'm surprised they bothered. Anyway, I'm just lucky that I wasn't a couple of years older, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have been such an easy ride. If I'd have been called up a couple of years earlier, because I was a couple of years older, it might not have been such an easy ride. If the build-up to D-Day, when they wanted all the gun fodder they could get, would it have been so plain sailing? Would they have registered me as a CO then? Probably I would have been directed to be a stretcher-bearer in the front line at bloody Normandy, something like that. I don't know if I would have gone on the run. I think I might have gone on the run. I don't know. It's difficult to say. Because, see, my half-brother that I mentioned earlier, Charlie, he joined the Royal... He was in the Royal Medical Corps. I forgot to mention. He was not into killing. He didn't want to kill anybody. He realised... He thought it was a just war in the sense that these tyrants and fascists had to be defeated. But he wasn't a vicious or violent person. He didn't want to kill anybody. But because he knew quite a lot about first aid, he was in the St. John's Ambulance Brigade or something before the war, and he knew quite a lot about first aid. So when he was called up, he mentioned that he was, you know, quite able in a lot of medical things, and could he join the Royal Medical Corps? And they said yes. So. That's what he was doing out in Singapore, in the Royal Medical Corps. And we think that's what saved his life, because I'm diverting slightly from my own history, but if anybody's interested, you can scrub this off if you don't want it. But from what he didn't talk much about his experiences. A lot of Japanese POWs didn't talk about their experiences. They were so horrific, friends dropping down dead all around you. But from the little snippets that he did let drop, we think he survived because of his medical knowledge. The Japanese needed somebody with medical knowledge as well as the British. And at first, he told my mother this, and my mother told me, but he didn't talk about it much with us. But he told my mother that the British officers forbade Charlie to do anything to aid or assist the Japanese, either putting a bandage on a Japanese soldier or putting back a dislocated shoulder or anything like that, or administering medicine. He was actually issued with a written order. You are forbidden to do anything. So, what does he do when the Japanese say, you're a member of the Royal Army Medical Corps, you have medical knowledge, come and treat this Japanese... Well, if it was an ordinary squaddy, they probably wouldn't bother, but if it was Japanese officer, they'd want him made good. So what was he to do? At first, he explained, I must refuse because I've got an order from my superior officer. So the Japanese commandant has a word with the superior of the British and says, fortunately, in the presence of other junior officers, if you allow your medical... Because Charlie wasn't